I hear you're injured.
Well, I've got something that I'm referring to as Zoom neck. You know how you can have like tennis elbow or swimmer's shoulder?
Yeah.
I'm imagining I'm not the only one. I mean, my husband's also got it, where you've been on Zoom calls too much and you always sit with your head forward and your neck's rather tired from it.
Oh, like craning a little bit.
Yeah. So we've dubbed it Zoom neck, and I think it's going to go into the medical textbooks before you know it.
I've got a related injury, which is jigsaw puzzler's back.
Oh yeah, that's awful. That's actually one of the reasons why I don't do jigsaw puzzles.
Some people have suggested I've just got a bad back because I'm living such a sedentary lifestyle at the moment. But I've always had a sedentary lifestyle, and the puzzle is the only thing that's new.
I guess you used to leave the house to go to work.
Not even really, some of the time. Anyway, how are you, Dominic Kramer?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Otherwise, I'm fine. Bit of a shame about the rain, but everything's going fine. How are you?
Well, thank you. I have been writing a nice pan-European feature about different countries' plans to reopen the schools, which has been very interesting to look at.
Yeah, they're citing this study in the Netherlands that says that they think kids don't spread the virus between them.
Not as much as we thought, but I mean, sorry, have you ever known a toddler? They're disgusting.
That's very scientific, Katie.
You can tell I'm not a parent. Anyway.
We'd better get on with the show. And we've got a nice one for you this week. We're going to be unpicking something that's become a bit of a buzzword recently, the circular economy. I've been hearing this model mentioned more and more over the past year, but I haven't actually spent the time working out what it really means. Luckily, we're speaking to someone who knows exactly what it means and what it would mean for Europe. Esther Goodwin-Brown, a circular jobs initiative analyst at the organisation Circle Economy, will be here a bit later on in the show to help give us more of an idea what it's all about and how our world could soon be changing for the better. One thing that makes me think that the world is changing for the better is our community of Patreon supporters. You don't have to join them. This podcast will always remain free. But if you fancy dropping a few monthly coins in our tip jar, then we would be ever so grateful. Head over to patreon.com/Europeans podcast or look for the link in our show notes.
The latest generous person to do this is Sarah Smith. Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. Let's get on with the show. Who's had a good week, Katie?
It has been a good week for the Norwegian chess champion, Magnus Carlsen, the world number one. I don't know if you've been following, Dominic, but Magnus has not been having a great time recently. Have you been following?
No, I actually haven't. Sorry.
So. You should have been. Chess is a very exciting and underrated sport. Magnus, who is 29, has been suffering at the hands of a 16-year-old chess prodigy called Alireza Firouzja. Apparently this kid is like crazy good. That's the technical chess term. And Magnus had suffered two humiliating defeats at the hands of Alireza recently. So when they came face to face again this week, Magnus said, and I quote, "I wanted to crush him," which is quite a mean way to talk about a 16-year-old boy.
Is there a minimum age for who can compete in these chess championships, or has he been going for ages, this 16-year-old?
No, he's already a veteran. He won the Iranian chess championship when he was only 12. So yeah, he's pretty pro at this point.
Whoa. And is chess like one of the only sports that's actually continuing now, along with marble racing?
Yeah, so for obvious reasons, there's lots of people stuck at home at the moment with time on their hands. And that's what Magnus and Alireza have been playing in this week. It's a new online championship, which was actually set up by Magnus himself. It's the Magnus Carlsen International. It's him versus seven of the other top chess champions from around the world. Weirdly, big online chess tournaments are like relatively new. Elite chess is still usually played with two people sitting in the same room, like staring dramatically at the board. And one of the reasons why online chess hasn't really taken off at the top level is that it's been quite hard to stop people from cheating. So like if you're playing from home, you could maybe sneakily open a new tab and like get the computer to work out what the best move is. This tournament has got quite strict anti-cheating measures to try and stop that happening. And all the players have to have like three cameras watching them and nothing else on their computers at the same time.
And so Magnus started a competition and then did he win himself?
It's actually still running, so it runs until May the 3rd. But he did indeed manage to crush his 16-year-old rival, Alireza. And at the time of recording, Magnus is still in first place, which is good because this competition has got his own name on it. Alireza, our poor 16-year-old Prodigy, he has not had a great week, so not only did he lose to Carlsen and another player, but his internet cut out while he was winning against the US champion, and the game ended up being declared a draw. Like, imagine how annoying that would be.
That's terrible. No wonder online chess hasn't taken off.
I think it's having a bit of a moment right now, though, so let's see where this goes. Anyway, it's been a good, if nerve-wracking week for Norway's very own Magnus Carlsen. But maybe you and I should start playing online chess against each other. Might be a nice break from podcasting.
Might help with my Zoom neck. No, it won't. I'll just make it worse.
Be terrible for your Zoom neck. Who's had a bad week?
It's been a bad week for coal.
Coal, the black, lumpy stuff that we burn.
Exactly. I think we already all know that coal-fired power plants are going out of fashion in Europe. The year 2019 saw the use of coal decline in every EU country. And on average, there was a drop of 24% compared to the year before. So it's quite a steep decrease. Coal has become less competitive in terms of price, with other sources ending up cheaper. And in 2019, we also saw more power in the EU being produced by renewables than by coal.
Coal is like really polluting, right?
Yeah. Coal is the most polluting of all the fossil fuels when burned, and it has a myriad of negative environmental outcomes, which I won't go into now because I think that argument was won quite a long time ago and everyone agrees it's bad. But coal has had a particularly bad week this week after it was announced that both Sweden and Austria have closed their final coal-fired power plants. Sweden had been hoping to wean itself off coal-fired power by 2022, but managed to get in there a few years early. They're clearly not deadline workers, unlike you, Katie.
What are you trying to say?
Well,
there have been some late nights recently. I'll be the first to admit it. Carry on.
And remarkably, just one day later, Austria announced the closure of its final coal-fired power plant, coming in with a photo finish bronze position as the third country in the EU to go coal-free.
So who's the gold medal winner then?
That was Belgium, who won that race back in 2016. So good work, Belgium. They were ahead of the curve. And the fate of coal in the EU is looking pretty bleak. Various other countries are planning on phasing it out completely over the next few years. And in fact, do you remember that amazing court case in the Netherlands where a relatively small non-profit won a ruling against the Dutch government for not doing enough to curb carbon emissions?
No.
Oh, we talked about it before.
We've been making this podcast for a long time. Refresh my memory.
It was this NGO called Urgenda who took the Dutch government to court saying that they weren't doing enough to decrease carbon emissions and reduce global warming. That was upheld in December by the Supreme Court, and the government therefore had to, by law, produce a raft of measures that would abide by that court ruling. And the headline measure was that they will quickly reduce capacity at the remaining coal-fired power stations in the Netherlands by 75%. This is pretty extraordinary, considering that three of the four power stations in the Netherlands were only built in the last 5 years. I mean, who thought that building new coal plants was a good idea 5 to 10 years ago? I don't know. We've known that it's bad for a long time. And it's a big waste of money that now these plants are going to have to be scaled back or even shut down. But it is extraordinary that this case of climate litigation led to this policy change. And it's really worth looking into it, Katie, because it's an inspiring model for how we can, if our legal systems allow it, force governments to act. I'll place a link in the show notes to an article in The Guardian this week so you can remind yourself.
Just to show that I have done my homework, you say that, like, who would build a coal power plant in the last 5 years, but aren't some countries still going, like, really big on coal? Like, I read that in the Balkans,
yeah,
Serbia and Kosovo are actually expanding coal power plants at the moment with some of that nice Chinese money.
Yeah, in the world as a whole, coal usage is still increasing year on year. So the EU countries are actually a kind of gold standard of what to do to wean yourself off coal. There are actually still some countries in the EU who are still pretty dependent on coal for power. Germany, Romania, Czechia and Bulgaria, for example, and Poland too, the only country in the EU that hasn't signed up to a zero carbon emissions pledge by 2050.
Boo.
Yeah, boo. That said, the coal industry in Poland is currently facing a bit of a crisis, and there were calls this week for a government bailout. the current decrease in demand for electricity in Poland due to the C word has placed extra pressure on these Polish coal plants that were already struggling due to increasingly competitive, cleaner forms of energy. I want to add that I imagine it's pretty concerning for the thousands of people employed across Europe in the coal industry, and I don't think we should just be joyously celebrating this without mentioning that. I do have empathy and obviously don't want loads of people to be left unemployed. So I'll round up this segment by saying that I hope this is just a bad week for burning coal and it's not a bad week for the employees of the coal industry. And let's hope that world leaders come up with some kind of Green New Deal to help these people transition to other forms of more sustainable employment. Oh, I know I said I was rounding up, but just after reading all about this all day yesterday, I woke up to the top headline in The Guardian being that the UK had managed to break a record for going the longest period without any of the coal-fired power plants contributing to the electricity grid. They made it over 18 days this week, which broke the previous record from last year, and it makes it the longest uninterrupted period of coal-free power in the UK since 1882.
Not bad. There's been some stuff going on over the past month, so you might have missed the fact that back in March, the EU released something called a Circular Economy Action Plan, which is designed to make our economy more circular. And that seems great, except neither of us really had any idea what that meant. What did you think it meant?
Yeah, I find it really difficult to understand economic models at all, so I guess I thought it was to do with recycling.
Yeah, or like generally making the economy greener in some way would be my best guess. It sounded jazzy anyway. But we wanted to know if the circular economy was just like a buzzword that's been knocking around recently, or whether it's something that actually has some substance to it. Who better to ask than a friend of Dominic's in Amsterdam, Esther Goodwin-Brown. Esther is an analyst at Circle Economy, which is an organisation that campaigns to get the circular economy brought in faster, partly by offering practical advice and help to cities and to governments who are trying to change how things are working. So we gave her a ring to find out more.
Esther, can we start with the basics? What is this circular economy that I've been hearing about? Is it basically a fancy word for recycling?
So it isn't just a fancy word for recycling, although that is quite a common misconception. So the circular economy is essentially a new economic model, but one which doesn't compromise between the economy, people, and the planet. And we often explain the circular economy compared to the linear economy, which is the system that dominates now. And that's where raw materials are extracted and turned into products. Those products are sold and typically used over a very short time period, and then they're disposed of and sent to landfill. And so the central principle of the circular economy is about keeping materials and products in circulation for as long as possible. So as well as recycling, it's about reuse and repair and remanufacturing and refurbishing products so that where possible, we slow down the rate at which products and materials are used, and we eventually design out waste and pollution.
Sounds great. What kind of things would have to change if we're actually going to do this?
So in order to transition to like a fully circular economy, a lot does need to change. And that includes fundamentally changing the way that we use products and produce them. And this will be made possible through governments taking leadership and really incentivizing companies to design products and buildings differently so that they last and can be repaired. To use more recycled materials in their products, to use more circular business models, so selling refurbished products at a lower cost, so that some of these sustainable choices are more accessible and affordable and become more mainstream to consumers.
So is the sole aim of this transition towards a circular economy to save the world from environmental destruction? I shouldn't be laughing. It's not fun.
No, that is, of course, one of the aims, but it's definitely not the only one. So as well as reducing our impact on the planet, it's absolutely about making sure that everyone can benefit from that new economic model. So there's also this social side of the circular economy that's about considering the workers that we need to produce these products that we use every day, and to make sure that the circular economy creates decent work opportunities for people with different skills and for communities in different geographies.
Can you give us a couple of examples of the sort of jobs that would be created if we had a more circular economy, or the kind of skills that people would need more than they have today?
Yeah, so there's lots of new jobs that could come out of this. So urban mining is already something that is happening in the Netherlands and other countries, where you basically source waste materials from, for example, construction sites, and make sure that those materials are then reused in other projects. So you have urban miners that its job is to responsibly demolish buildings and know the quality and the lifetime of different materials so that they can be reused safely. But then it's also a lot about existing jobs that we really take for granted. So people that work in waste management, in our food systems, in, you know, the local repair shop, they're really, really core to the circular economy. So this work is also about making sure there's enough recognition and value around those really core jobs as well.
This is presumably a kind of thinking that does exist in reality to some extent, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. A really lovely example, I think, of a social enterprise actually based here in Amsterdam called Makers Unite. They began their model by upcycling life vests from Greece and turning them into new products like laptop cases and bags.
Oh, these are all the life jackets that are left by refugees arriving on the islands, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. And what's fantastic about them is that it's like a circular model, both in terms of the material sense, so the life jackets that they're using, giving those a second life, but it's also has real social impacts, because they are working predominantly with newcomers to the Netherlands that bring with them some really strong skills in like design and embroidery. And so they also create this like network of alumni of creatives here in the Netherlands. And at the moment, they're producing around 300 or 500 face masks, protective face masks a day, which is pretty cool, and just showing how quickly they can adapt in the current situation.
Yeah, that's amazing. It all sounds really great, and I think we should do this now, as in transition to the circular economy. But what are some of the biggest challenges that we all still need to overcome in order to make this transition realistic?
So on a basic level, it's about creating more understanding of what the circular economy is. So you hinted earlier that there can be some confusion, that it's a bit nebulous, and that people think it's just a lot about recycling. It's about making sure that the right funding is available from government so that businesses that do want to implement new circular models can do. And there's also a really big challenge around understanding what the ripple effects of transitioning to a fully circular economy might be for different people and different workers. And that's the focus of my work. If one country decides to become fully circular and not produce any new products anymore, what happens to the people that are currently working in factories on the other side of the globe producing the products for those countries? So there's all these considerations that we have to work through. And there's a lot to be done to make sure that we really understand and can mitigate like the full range of these impacts on different people.
When we talk about recycling and, you know, things like whether we should use straws or not, there are sometimes complaints that like you, the individual, you stopping using straws or whatever it is, that's not going to make any difference. And what really needs to change is the behavior of big corporations. In the circular economy model, how much responsibility is given to corporations as opposed to like individual people in terms of changing how we behave?
I mean, there's obviously a lot we can do as individuals, but I really think the focus needs to be on corporations and on governments incentivizing those corporations to make changes. We absolutely, as consumers, need to make sure the things that we buy last for as long as possible, you know, getting clothes repaired or opting to buy a service model rather than own our own washing machines. But we really need governments to be incentivizing businesses to make these options more accessible and affordable, so that, you know, the individuals that are already starting to change their behavior are also met hand in hand with the, you know, the corporations who create the bulk of the waste doing their part.
And are you finding that policymakers and politicians are receptive to these ideas?
Generally, policymakers are receptive. I think where the circular economy is understood, there's generally consensus that it's a good idea. And there's lots of countries in Europe that are already setting ambitious targets, like here in the Netherlands, where the government has set itself the target of being fully circular by 2050. But it's how to implement the circular economy, which becomes more complicated, and policymakers still really need to prioritise the topic and make sure that the right regulations and funds and cooperation schemes are in place that the circular economy can become a reality and benefit the people and planet as it needs to.
It's definitely an idea that there's been a lot of buzz around over the last year or so, and definitely at the EU level, lots of European politicians have been talking about how Europe needs to transition towards a circular economy. What could the EU itself do to actually make that happen?
So the EU definitely has a very important role to play, encouraging collaboration within Europe, but also with countries and continents outside of Europe. Because the circular economy doesn't just mean becoming self-sufficient within our own national borders. And the European Commission itself has already been doing quite a lot of work on the concept of the circular economy for a few years. And they actually released their updated circular economy action plan in March this year.
One of the reasons why we wanted to talk to you today and why we've been thinking about circular economy is because of that rare piece of good news that has been whizzing around the internet. There was an article in The Guardian that was going a bit viral, at least in my social media bubble, about the fact that our home city of Amsterdam has been working with your organisation and with the economist Kate Raworth to transform Amsterdam's economy towards a circular economy, also using Kate's donut model economy, which is something a bit different, but I think connected. I know you've not been working on this project specifically, but is this commitment from the municipality of Amsterdam as exciting as it seems?
Definitely. It's particularly exciting because Amsterdam's the first city to adopt this donut model as a way of shaping public policy. So it's a way of balancing the needs of its own citizens and global citizens without overshooting the boundaries of the planet. And they've actually already developed their circular economy strategy for 2025 using the donut as a compass.
Did you see the new research from Pompeii this week? Evidence that the Romans were recycling back in the day.
That's so cool.
They found these like huge mounds of trash outside the city of Pompeii, which had been assumed to just be places to dump rubbish. But now researchers believe that they were, quote, staging grounds for cycles of use and reuse. For example, reusing ceramic and plaster in construction work. So the Romans invented recycling, and it kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Like, why wouldn't you reuse things? It's easier and cheaper.
It is just common sense. The Romans were really great when they weren't, like, you know, enslaving people and carrying out public executions.
Guess what the happy ending is about, Katie?
I have no idea.
Metal detecting.
Dominic and I have been slightly obsessed with metal detecting recently. I can't remember why. Why did we get obsessed with this?
Because I just kept bringing you happy endings that were to do with metal detectors.
Oh, yeah. And then I started watching that BBC TV show, Detectorists, which is about metal detectors. And it's very gentle and nice. Anyway, what is the happy ending this week?
The happy ending comes from a woman called Iris van den Boom, who's a journalist living in the Netherlands. And she was driving home one day and noticed her wedding ring had disappeared. She was devastated and started racking her brain for where it could have gone. She had a few ideas. Could it have been when she was on the bus? Was it during that interview she did in Soest? Or could it have been when she took her gloves off at the equestrian centre she'd been visiting? None of her investigations led to any success, but she did decide as a last resort to post about her lost ring on her Twitter account. No luck for months, over 6 months in fact, until one day a message popped up on her Facebook. Someone had found her ring.
Yay!
A farmer who liked doing metal detecting in his spare time had been passing his machine over a field of mushrooms and he found this ring in the mud. He saw there was a small inscription inside the ring, typed the words into Twitter along with lost ring, and found Iris's tweet saying that she'd lost her ring. Iris cried when she received the message saying her ring had been found. But then she thought, how did my ring end up in this field?
She hadn't been mushrooming recently, had she?
No, she hadn't. And it was many kilometres away from anywhere she'd been in the time period when she lost her ring. It turns out mushroom fields really like horse manure. And this particular mushroom field had horse manure from the very equestrian centre that Iris had visited back in September.
No way!
I know. So Iris is totally thrilled, as is the farmer who found it. Iris did, however, realise that the ring really is a bit too big for her, and she's promised to get it resized when she can, so that it doesn't go on any more adventures.
Does she mind that it's been sitting in manure for quite a long time, or is she not really bothered?
She said when she received it, it was still coated in manure, but I think she'll be giving it a good clean. Have you got any isolation inspiration this week, Katie?
Yeah, well, last week I was reading Frankenstein in the bath. This week I'm planning on watching Frankenstein, the stage version from a few years back with Benedict Cumberbatch in it, because the National Theatre in the UK has kindly decided to put it on YouTube for us to enjoy while on lockdown.
Oh, that was a huge hit, wasn't it?
Was it? I don't know. You're the, like, cultured one.
Yeah, I remember it sold out very quickly. I actually have a feeling I saw it and I've just completely forgotten everything about it.
Well, you can refresh your memory, much as I will be doing with my Dutch litigation. What have you been reading or watching?
I've been exploring this nice website called wordsworth250.com. I'm afraid it's also from Britain. But, you know, it was the 250th anniversary of the romantic poet William Wordsworth at the beginning of this month. And there were meant to be loads of celebrations around the country, particularly in the Lake District, which obviously all had to be cancelled because of you-know-what. The family, his descendants, started by just sending each other little messages of themselves reading his poems as a way of commemorating his amazing work. And this has expanded into something quite amazing with celebrities like Stephen Fry and Ruth Wilson and Davina McCall getting involved and reading poems. And they've put them all together on a quite like basic but really charming website called wordsworth250.com. And I enjoyed listening to a few of them.
Lovely. Just to give us a non-British cultural recommendation, I'm also really enjoying at the moment a French comedy series about the EU, in fact, called Parlement. And should we let the cat out of the bag and tell us who the guest is next week?
Yeah, go on.
Next week, we're going to have the screenwriter of that very show, Noé Desprez, on as our guest. So you have that to look forward to. In the meantime, if you want to hang out with us on the internet this week, you can find us on a range of social media websites, including
Twitter at Europeans Pod, Instagram Europeans Podcast, Facebook the Europeans Podcast, or email us hello@europeanspodcast.com.
That just rolls off the tongue these days. You've really got it down.
Finally, 2 years in.
See you next week, everyone.
Bye.